This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. The People's Climate March, Sunday, September 21st, hundreds of thousands take to the streets to demand an economy that works for people and the planet, a world safe from the ravages of climate change, a world with good jobs, clean air and water, and healthy communities.
Well, dialogue with Christian Parenti, professor of sustainable development at the School for International Training Graduate Institute. He is a contributing editor to The Nation and the author of four books, the most recent being Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence.
And with Mary Sweeters, Greenpeace Arctic campaigner and coordinator in the Global Climate March. Mary has spent the last 7 years at Greenpeace organizing numerous communities around climate change. She's participated in an action hanging a giant banner on Mount Rushmore to call out President Obama to take action on climate change. And she's recently studied and raised awareness of the meltdown of the polar ice caps and the dangers of Arctic oil drilling. But right now, to begin, we're going to listen to a promo for the march.
All of the big social movements in history have had people in the streets.
We as a people will get to the promised land.
All of us must stand up together.
In our past, masses of people have taken the wheel of history and turned it. We have a responsibility to rise to our historical moment.
This is the singular issue of our time that will determine how we live, where we live, and if we live.
The scientific warnings keep intensifying, yet there has been no effective political response.
The tipping points that we face are a catastrophic shift that threatens everything we love, and it happens like that.
Each day of inaction, business as usual, puts us closer and closer on this crash course.
Climate disruption is a social justice issue. Who gets hit first and worst every time?
What my country is going through as a result of this climate event is madness.
This is not just about the environment. It's about the community. It's about jobs. It's about justice. Yes, yes, yes,
yes. This is not a green issue. This is an all of us issue.
This is going to have to be the fight of our lives.
It's communities of people coming together that will solve this.
The most fateful battle in human history. We will fight it together.
There is no replacement for human bodies standing as one, voices raised as one, making a political demand.
And we're going to begin our conversation with Mary Sweeters. Mary, how did you get to the top of Rushmore to hang this banner out addressed to President Obama?
There were a team of activists, using some of our skills and our experience, folks were able to climb the monument, and some of our skilled climbers were able to hang a banner over the face of the monument to the right of the last face, and be able to get our message out to President Obama and to the rest of the world.
And what was that message?
The message was that America honors leaders, not politicians. And we need to see that leadership from the Obama administration and other world leaders in order to address climate change.
And let me ask you to begin with your interest in this issue. What has made you into the Greenpeace organizer? I always like to try to figure out what stimulates somebody's consciousness around a particular subset of concerns.
Sure. You know, I think it's something that I've been interested in for years and years prior to working as a professional organizer. Just as I learned more about climate change and my own education growing up throughout college, and when I was in college, we invaded Iraq and Afghanistan. And so seeing some of the connections there to, fighting over resources and seeing what environmental destruction comes from some of our policies and seeing what world leaders were and were not doing to address some of these different issues. Just kind of started to piece things together. And I think, you know, that's really motivated me to work on climate change for the last several years, is knowing that so much of this is interconnected and that this is an issue about people, that it is about communities who are, you know, currently suffering from, you know, real threats that are going on right now, and that there are decisions that are being made by governments and there's influence made by corporations that are, you know, the reason that that's happening.
Greenpeace, as I have experienced the organization through the media and so on, is an aggressive organization that has fought Japanese whalers who were destroying whales on our high seas. It has taken aggressive action, often putting itself on the front lines in the effort to preserve the oceans, the climate, raise up the issues of SOS, Save Our Planet. And what attracted you particularly to Greenpeace, and how do you respond to the methodologies that they use to raise the issue of the imperative of climate-based issues being embedded in all of the endeavors that any one of us takes up?
You know, what interests me in the way that Greenpeace approaches our work and is really coming from a fundamental place of direct action and using nonviolence as a means to get the message out to folks, to educate people, and then to mobilize them. So I firmly believe in the use of nonviolence and its effectiveness, as we've seen throughout history, in social movements. And I think, you know, climate change is certainly a social movement. And it's something, to me, that Greenpeace really speaks to me, because we're using both nonviolent direct action when it's necessary in our campaigning to show that these issues are so urgent that sometimes people may need to put their, you know, risk their freedom in order to call attention, in order to stop something from happening, in order to, you know, push for the solutions that we actually need. Because these are life or death situations in many places in the world. And I think, you know, using nonviolence, one, is something that's just core to my own principles personally, but I think it's also something that is really, really effective in making change.
Do you feel that you've been effective in making change relevant to the communities of youth that you have sought to organize with, or have they picked up the message? Is it something that is enticing to them? Do they feel the imperative as you do?
Absolutely. I have worked also in some of my past work with Greenpeace has been organizing youth and training youth. And I think this generation, the millennial generation, this is their issue. Climate change is something that they can see happening right before their eyes, that they know will affect their future. And so I think that the youth of today, we've seen time and time again, rising up, getting in the streets, you know, risking their own freedoms, in different communities all around the country and around the world, to take a stand and to say, this is our future, and we are, you know, demanding that it's clean and safe and secure, and that, you know, our leaders need to be doing something now.
Mary, I'm wondering if you feel that operating under capitalism, which certainly, or really what I would call today a plutocracy, where corporations are supreme, where they're given the rights of personhood, of speech, of religious prerogative, and so on, do you feel that there is a way that we can, under capitalism, wean ourselves away from the corporate hierarchy that is really responsible in its hunger for profits, for giving us a world of nonstop toxicity? I mean, I'm still haven't recovered from the Exxon Valdez oil spill, or from the BP oil spill and the continuation of drilling off our coast. What do you think?
Yeah, that's a great question. I absolutely agree that corporations have their role in, you know, our government and what decisions get made is far too influential. They play a role that is far too prominent. And I think that, you know, we need to look at what can we, knowing that this is our system right now, what ways can we change things to make our future better? We've seen some corporations change for the better. You know, many companies, like tech companies, for example, are moving toward investing in cleaner energy and demanding from the utilities that are helping to power their data centers that they use clean energy, and in that way are helping to shift that whole economy of that sector. So I think that this is something that we need to look at very carefully and demand, you know, a real change from corporations. I think, you know, pointing out the connections between the influence that corporations have, we've seen it time and again in places like North Carolina. We see it in, you know, in Shell Oil. They are a prime example of where, you know, capitalism allows for our general well-being to be put at risk, where the U.S. government is right now leasing permits for Shell to drill offshore in the Arctic in a place where ice is melting because of climate change, and the government is allowing Shell to take advantage of that to go and attempt to drill for more oil, which is putting us in this position in the first place. So now, we absolutely make a change.
One of the things that is also interesting to me about you is that you study and raise awareness of the meltdown of the polar ice caps and the dangers of Arctic oil drilling. Talk to us about the meltdown and what that means, and then we'll also look at the issue of the Arctic oil drilling.
I am an Arctic campaigner. That's my current role right now. I've come close, but up in Alaska, but I haven't actually visited the region myself. Although I have worked with several folks who have visited, and in fact, a series of colleagues brought up the climate commissioner from the Philippines to highlight the effects that a melting Arctic has on a place like the Philippines. Many people wouldn't make that connection to why a place that seems so remote for many of us, like the Arctic, would have an impact on people there. But the Arctic melting is affecting not only the 4 million people who live in the region, but it's also affecting people around the world. As the Arctic melts and the area there becomes more unstable, you know, the Arctic actually kind of acts like a regulator, almost like a refrigerator, if you will, for the planet. And as that becomes more unstable, it's causing other areas of the globe to become unstable as well. So we are seeing some of these more extreme weather events, things like Hurricane Sandy or Typhoon Haiyan or droughts. Those are happening, and they are connected to the Arctic melting and destabilizing. And so what we're seeing is that the Arctic is actually affecting all of us. And, you know, it's not something that just stays where it is. This is something that is a global issue. And as governments allow oil companies to take advantage of these opening oceans and the melting ice to go in and drill for more oil, this is something that is just putting us further down that path, and we need to be correcting over to clean renewable energy and looking at the Arctic as something that's a real signal to us that we need to be taking action now. I've been north up into Alaska, and I can tell you that, you know, areas there that are in a great expanse, beautiful wilderness, areas that are, you know, hardly touched by humans, that's something that we should look to see, hey, this is something that we need to be preserving. This is something that not only for the biodiversity of these regions, but also for the people who depend on these places for their own livelihood and their own survival. And it's something that is, you know, incredibly stunning and incredibly inspiring to people who visit it, but we also need to remember that there are people who live there. And this is what they call home, and it's something that we need to, you know, work together with them to protect.
You know, one of the things that I remember from some years ago, I was in a very small area, Utah, Alabama, and I was actually doing some voters' rights work there. And at that time, there was the importation of toxic waste, and they were going to be dumping in the area. And there would be money made off of that. And, of course, it was an entirely African-American community. And there was no sense of concern as to what this would mean for the African-American population, etc. So one of the issues that certainly has come up for me within the context of our urban communities, as well as rural communities, is questions of the disparity of response, of environmental racism which did not seem to be something that was of great concern to the broader environmental movement, which still seemed to be overwhelmingly white in terms of organizations like Greenpeace, organizations like NYPIRG, and so on. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's a great point. You know, I think there have been communities of color who have been organizing and fighting against environmental racism for decades. And this is something that I think there's been a bit of a disconnect between some of the larger environmental organizations in the United States and those communities. And I think we're starting to bridge those gaps in many places. For folks who might not be as familiar with it, the environmental racism that we're seeing is, you know, for example, where communities of color, low-income communities, they often live next to pollution and they bear the brunt of it. And we're in, as you gave the example of, you know, toxic waste, there have been many famous examples, especially in the South, of communities that were living next to toxic dump sites who were bearing the brunt of that pollution and getting sick from it. And I think, you know, now more and more larger environmental organizations are recognizing that and wanting to work in solidarity to support those communities. Greenpeace, you know, has been doing some of that work, for example, in North Carolina, working to promote solar energy as an accessible solution that we want everyone to be able to use, promoting energy efficiency as a way that people can both lower their utility bills, you know, make gains and contribute to solutions toward climate change. So I think that there's definitely that gap is starting to close, but we certainly have a ways to go. And I think, you know, the People's Climate March, this is a really great example of that all coming together. This is a chance for everyone to be coming out and turning out in the streets, both large environmental groups, local, you know, communities of color, local low-income communities who are there on the front lines bearing the brunt of this pollution. In the case of climate change, they are often right in the backyard of power plants that are, you know, causing asthma levels to go through the roof, contributing to other health effects. And at the same time, that pollution is also exacerbating climate change, which reaches right back to those communities who may not have the infrastructure to withstand some of the severe storms that we're seeing, some of the more severe weather patterns. And so the People's Climate March, I think, is a great example of all of these communities coming together and saying, we are the voice of the people who are facing climate change, and well, we are demanding a, you know, a better future.
That's an interesting point, and it's a good time to bring Christian Parente into the discussion. Christian, within the context of capitalism and operating within a plutocracy, is it really possible to do more than take up these demands, but to really effectuate any change without having a systems change, when we know that corporations which control are driven by unlimited greed?
I mean, I think that you need to think in terms of the short term and the long term. And capitalism has a multifaceted environmental crisis. Climate change is just one part of that. So for human civilization to be sustainable, there's going to have to be total restructuring implied in your question. However, the science around climate change is very clear that we have to decarbonize our economy very, very quickly. And it's not realistic to think that we can achieve all of the other changes that will be constituted in building out a whole new different social system to just decarbonize the economy. So I think there has to be a short-term reformist agenda, which is around forcing capitalism to euthanize the fossil fuel industry and build out a clean energy sector. And that if that could happen, that doesn't actually solve the environmental crisis, which is this multifaceted thing, right? It involves overfishing, it involves soil erosion, toxicity of the environment, on and on and on. But climate change is the most pressing and most potentially cataclysmic in the short term of the overall environmental crisis. And it has to be dealt with in the short term. And I think that if there is a strong enough political movement, that it's certainly within the capacity of this society, as messed up as it is and exploitative in many ways, that it's certainly within the capacity of the society. We have the technology. We have the money. We actually even have the laws on the book to force the beginning of the euthanization of the fossil fuel industry. It does mean that if we're serious about this, we also have to take the short-term time frame of climate science very seriously and come up with a strategy that operates within that time frame. If people aren't clear on what that is, there are tipping points. The climate system, we now know, doesn't change slowly and gradually in a linear fashion, but rather the causes can build up and then the effects kick in all at once, and you can get rapid and sudden disintegration of environmental systems that life depends on. So what we're dealing with is a fight to avoid the tipping points. After the tipping points, the risk is that the main cause of greenhouse gas emissions becomes the breakdown of natural systems. So, for example, if the permafrost fully melts and all of the methane trapped under it in the Arctic is released, there'll be a massive release of a very powerful short-lived greenhouse gas, methane. If that happens, or if all of the boreal forests in the north die and go from being net carbon sinks to actual emitters of greenhouse gases like methane and CO2, we could see a situation where the main source of emissions is the collapse of natural systems and the burning of fossil fuels. Right now, the good and bad news, as it were, is that we, human beings, our civilization, burning fossil fuels, is the main cause of greenhouse gas emissions. That means it's still in our hands to deal with. If we cross these thresholds, it could really just be completely beyond our control to address.
Christian, I wanted you to get to some short-term but very concrete proposals that you made in one of your recent articles that Obama could do immediately, and one had to do with the federal government, and one had to do with the Clean Air Act.
Government in general, not just the federal government, is crucial to the economic health of capitalism as it is, right? First thing we have to do is we have to forget the neoliberal story that government only gets in the way and that the market operates on its own. That's not true at all, right? Capitalism is always dependent on actually the innovative driving role of the government as investor and as consumer of new technologies. So acknowledging that fact, you realize, okay, how have technologies come to scale in the past? And there's always been a role of the government, not just in like funding R&D, but also consuming them. So the airlines were helped out, essentially created through government contracts, consuming their services, et cetera, et cetera. So the government has to use its power of consumption, and it is a huge consumer of energy, to start consuming clean energy. Because what the clean energy sector needs is customers. Much more than it needs investment, it needs demand. People and institutions using electricity generated from wind and solar, et cetera. So the government has 450,000 mostly large, just the federal government, mostly large, very inefficient office buildings. They're all buying electricity to run their lights and air conditioning. Why not demand that electricity be procured through green sources? If the federal government started doing that, that would help build out the markets that the clean energy sector needed. If that happened, if there were markets, if there was demand for clean energy, then private money would flow into building out the supply to meet that demand. Three key ingredients to think about in this are that we have technology, we have the money, and we have the law. The technology is, we're not sitting here wishing that we could invent the photovoltaic solar panel, or that, you know, it was possible to build really big commercial scale windmills. All that stuff exists. Right? We're not sitting here being like, God, wouldn't it be great if we had a national grid where everything was connected? Like, we have a national grid, and you can plug in small electricity into it. So we have the technology, right? Electric cars are. We have the money. The public sector, the federal and state governments, are over one-third of U.S. economic activity. If we harnessed all of that consumption to drive building out these clean energy markets, that would be enormous. Similarly in states, they could start retrofitting those buildings. They could commit to a schedule of purchasing clean power. There are the vehicle fleets of states, and this is now actually starting to happen. There are 8 states that are moving towards trying to electrify their fleets because the federal government isn't doing anything about this, really. So the federal government, you know, has huge fleets of vehicles. Absolutely no reason that those shouldn't be electric vehicles. So it could help build out a huge market for electric vehicles. Consumption is like pretty low-hanging fruit. This is about, you know, redirecting money that has to be spent, that will be spent. The federal government will buy vehicles and it will buy fuel for those vehicles. It will keep the lights on in its office buildings. And we don't need the permission of science-denying Republicans to make sure that happens. There's also, if the government starts moving with its consumption, that drives all this private sector money. There's enormous amounts of money parked in corporate America. This isn't even money that's distributed as profits to shareholders. This is money that's retained by firms for investments that they're just sitting on. It's now up to $5 trillion, according to the Federal Reserve, higher than it's been at any time since the 1950s. Firms are just loaded with money, and they don't know what to do. If they got cues from government, they had more than enough capital to help build out clean tech sector. The final thing, laws. We don't need new climate legislation. We have the Clean Air Act. The EPA has to regulate greenhouse gas emissions because under the Clean Air Act of 1970, these constitute harmful forms of pollution. It takes 10 years for that case to go through the Supreme Court, and it's one of the early cases the Roberts Court hears, and they say, yes, the EPA has the obligation, not the right if it wants to, it has the obligation to regulate greenhouse gas emissions, and it has to do that according to the Clean Air Act, according to the best science, right? All right, so then this is something that, unfortunately, a lot of environmental groups don't take as seriously as they could. I think one group that really does is the Center for Biological Diversity. They've been pushing this fact, which is that we already have the legislation we need. That was one of the great tragedies of the Obama administration, wasting all that time and political capital on coming up with comprehensive climate legislation that was never going to pass. We already have it. It's called the Clean Air Act, amended by Massachusetts versus EPA. And we're waiting for the federal government to issue rules. They've issued a few rules from this, like only three rules now. But the implication is they have to have specific rules on what mass the EPA does to every sector of the economy. Right now, the EPA is taking comment on how to regulate existing coal-fired power plants. If there was enough pressure, as there has been on the FCC around net neutrality and other things like that, these agencies can be pressured to do the right thing.
We're going to have to hold it there. And Christian Parenti, thank you very much. And people really need to read the articles in Dissent, A Radical Approach to the Climate Crisis, and an extremely engaging and important book that shows how climate issues result actually in wars. And that book is?
Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence.
Thanks. And hey, SOS, save our planet. Christian Parenti, Mary Sweetis, thank you for being with us. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.